Get ready. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is almost here. It's Black Friday in July, and it's coming your way. For 5 days only, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping on everything. Yes, everything right to your door. So mark your calendars. Wayfair's Black Friday in July sale starts July 24th. Shop everything home at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Your voice is your weapon. And if you are silent, then you're giving away your power. So understanding that, I think, is really crucial. And understanding that this democracy that was so fought for, this democracy that we did inherit from these young people who fought for us, it's extremely precious. And it takes all of us right now to protect it. It's hard, but we have to do the hard work.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and welcome to Justice by Design, because we know justice doesn't happen on its own. It happens through the efforts of real people doing real work to bring about real solutions. So I have to be honest with you all today. I am coming into this episode with a specific type of energy because we are recording this right on the heels of the news that a Georgia appellate court has disqualified Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis, as well as her entire office, from the election interference case against President-elect Donald Trump and the other defendants in that case. Those of you who listen to hashtag sisters-in-law know well my position on this case. I see this as a clear example of an obstacle, the many obstacles that people, and particularly Black women who are trying to defend democracy and uphold the rule of law, face. They face obstacles at every turn, and I consider this a travesty, and I'm actually enraged by it. So if you hear something different in my voice for this podcast, that's where it's coming from. But I am very glad to be joined today in this discussion about resistance. That's what we're talking about today. And I'm just thrilled to be joined by Rita Omoka, who is a journalist and an author, the author of a great book called How a Century of Young Black Activists Shaped America, something that I highly recommend. I'm about halfway through it so far. But Rita, thank you so much for joining me on Justice by Design.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
And before we get started, just introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners. Tell us who you are, what you do.
Yeah, I am a reporter. I focus on race relations and the vulnerable. I am also an adjunct professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism.
My alma mater. I'm so glad you're there. So, you know, I in reading this book, and I was really struck not just about what you write throughout about young Black activists who have done the work throughout the history of our nation in bringing about change, but also the origin story of this book. It came after we all watched George Floyd being lynched on the street in Minneapolis. And in the book, you wrote, "As I watched him cry out for help, it hit me. I am part of them." Talk about that and the reason why you wrote this book.
Yeah, that specific line, I am part of them, is just, I think there's something that happens with most people who don't realize that they're living in insulation because you don't know what you don't know. And the preface to that line, I was talking about how I'm an immigrant to this country. I came to this country because my mother was granted access to this country. She was the beneficiary of the Immigration Act of 1990, which was looking to go to places like Africa and the Philippines, because at that time, there was a nursing shortage in this country. So they went to different places, and my mom was recruited. There was a series of examinations, and she was selected. And so we grew up.
And she grew up in Nigeria.
Yeah. Born and raised in Nigeria. She grew up there. She came here, I think, like in her late 30s. So we came here and we lived in the South Bronx, and we didn't really know anything. Like, we didn't know what the history of this country was. all we knew was survival. I think a lot of immigrants come to this country, they're wide-eyed, they're staring at all the opportunities in this country. And that's exactly what we did, especially how we came to this country through my mom and her academic excellence, her diligence, her resilience. Like, she literally changed the lineage of our family because of her dedication to her craft. So we grew up with that. That was kind of like my baseline understanding of what it takes to be in this country. Is just work hard and everything else will work for you. And for me personally, that was exactly my story. Academically, I succeeded. I went to good schools. I was selected for multiple elite programs. So in a way, that was my own insulation because I wasn't seeing the ills of this country because I wasn't intentional about learning about the ills of this country. Even when I went to, you know, major corporations, I worked for CNN, you know, NBC, Viacom in advertising. I always felt special in a way because I was always the one in the room. And I didn't feel like I was in the room because of my skin color. I just felt like academically, and I earned it by merit. So when I say that in the book, I meant like I just was ignorant. And because I was benefiting, I was privileged in a sense, because when you don't understand the history of something and when you're not part of that history, it's almost a privilege. Because, for example, I think Black Americans, they navigate this country understanding that they were subjugated and they are subjugated. Because in their homes, for example, they may have a grandmother who's telling them stories about the Jim Crow days, who's telling them stories about, you know, these white people, they're out to get us, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't have that growing up. And to me, that's a privilege to walk this country just thinking everything's great. You know, all I have to do is work really hard and everything's going to come for me. And lucky enough for me, that did happen. But for the vast majority of people, there is that psychological element, I believe, that limits them. So I say I was part of the problem only because I wasn't doing my part. I wasn't trying to be more inclusive, not because I was intentionally not being inclusive. I just didn't even know what the language was. I didn't understand racism, discrimination, microaggressions. I didn't know any of it. And so that's what led me to say that, because that's my truth and that's my story. In terms of how the book came to be, going back to 2020, so much was happening, as you mentioned. Yes. There was the death of Breonna Taylor, the killing of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and then George Floyd happened. And I think that just catapulted the world into this new kind of sense of urgency to do something. And there was this laser focus on race relations. And that's what I study, and that's what I'm really interested in. So what I wanted to do was go out into the country, you know, and part of me trying to become more intentional and learn about race and racism and discrimination was that. So I went to 30 states in 32 days. I was looking to have those
pause there for a minute. You went to 30 states in 32 days. That is quite a cross-country trip.
It was. I was just hungry. You know, I'm such a natural extrovert. And that was during COVID. So much was happening that year. And I was just hungry for conversation, but really hungry to excavate what it really means to be all of us at that time. I was really happy to have a wide range of conversations with, you know, Black people, Hispanic, Native Americans and Hispanics and all the spectrum, white Americans, to really understand how we were all navigating that time. And so, yes, I went to 30 states in 32 days. And one of the stops that I went to that really piqued my interest and want to go down this line of research was in Portland. In Portland, I went to my first ever protest. I had never been socially or civically engaged in that way. So I'd never been to a protest. So usually when I would travel around the different states, my first thing would be like park my car and just walk randomly around looking for people who were out, because that was during COVID. So most people were at home. So yeah. I'm just like, whoever's on the street, you're my target. But then, you know, I'm walking around Portland and I see this massive congregation of just young people at this like public square. And I'm like, what's going on there? So I just put myself in there and just started talking to them to understand what was going on. And so they were leading this protest in remembrance of Patrick Kimmons, who was another young Black man killed at the hands of police. But also the protest was really twofold as well. It was remembering Patrick Kimmons, but also decrying the times we were in. And as I just watched them match, you know, march down this you know, half a mile walk from the public square to the parking lot where this young man had been killed, I was just stunned by the movement. There were so many people who were like keenly aware of what was happening. And it kind of challenged me in a way, because I'm like, when I was 13, 14, 15, I wasn't even thinking about any of this. I was just, again, survival mode, trying to assimilate to this country. None of these things were coming to my mind. So that line of questioning led me to think, how did I really know that they can actually have the power to organize and galvanize and protest in this way? So that line of questioning is what led me to research the book.
And in the book, you highlight the work of young Black activists mm-hmm. from the entirety of American history. Talk about some of these activists who you highlight and why you chose them as a result of this journey that you went on yourself.
Yeah, that was the hardest part. I wanted to showcase specifically lesser known people, because I think we know the names of like mostly men, right? We know the John Lewis's, MLK, Malcolm X. We know, you know, Bayard Rustin. We know all of those like men who were really at the forefront. So I really wanted to, because usually even today in our communities, a lot of people in the background are the ones doing most of the heavy lifting, but they're still, you know, not as known and given their flowers, as they say. So I really wanted to focus on that first, but I still wanted to talk about people who were a bit more well-known. So I start with Ella Baker, because everyone sees her as like the mother, the grandmother of the civil rights movement. So she has to be in there. But one of my favorites to study and research was Barbara Johns, just because I felt so much parallels to my life. One of the things that made her get politically charged and really engaged socially and civically was her uncle, Vernon. Her uncle, Vernon, was a minister, but he was also this well-known local activist. So he was balancing the spiritual, but also the practical. So he was telling people, this is Jim Crow time, but he was telling people, you know, your voice is your weapon. Your voice is your power. Just because we are subjugated by the system, if we build a coalition, we can do something. There's power in numbers. So she watched this happen. She also grew up with her paternal grandmother and her maternal grandmother, who were formerly enslaved. And they talked to her about what that meant and how, even though in the time they were in the 1950s, there was still a lot happening with the Jim Crow laws, separate but equal, but they felt they still had a bit more freedom. And Barbara was taking all of this in, just ingesting this, and she was just growing. And that built her framework to say, this, my situation, she was going to a school that was an all-Black school. They had horrible conditions. I mean, substandard conditions. They were going to school in, you know, tar paper shacks. When it rained on them, overcrowded, that they had to sometimes have classes in their school buses. It was just horrible. And what was worse for her is every morning she's on her school bus and she's passing the all-white school, Farmville High School, and they're getting new gardens every day, a new library, I mean, reconstructions all the time, whereas her school was nothing. So for her, she felt like she had a confluence of things like really influencing how she saw the world. So though with her eyes, she saw things were horrible, she was dreaming of a time where we can all just have the same resources. Like, how is that not the right thing to do? And that's what led her to lead a massive student strike in town. So disruptive, it caught the attention of the school board. They paid attention. But more importantly, it caught the attention of the NAACP, who at the time, they were working on the Brown versus Board of Education case. And what I find just so fascinating about her is, of the 177 students who were represented in that case, there were five consolidated cases in that case, 117 came from the strike that she led in Prince Edward County. Wow. So many people like that, many young people like that, who did incredible things that still have lasting effects today. And that's how I was able to narrow it down. It was hard to narrow it down, but people like Barbara made it easy when I just connected with them. And I felt like there was a connection to my own life too, and how I became, you know, kind of socially engaged as well.
And so what can we learn in this moment in 2024 where we are in a period of great transition and we are in a period that even I'm a journalist too, I am public facing, but I too am sort of reckoning with this idea of what I am doing is part of a resistance. It is a part of a resistance in furthering trying to ensure that justice still lives on despite all the factors lined up against it. And that include that justice includes equality, racial equality, as well as equality in a number of other forms. And I think there are a lot of people, Rita, right now who are coming to terms with that too. But at the same time, we're tired, we're frustrated, we're exacerbated in this moment today. As I mentioned, I'm angry. Yeah. So how can we be inspired by the story of these activists who faced incredible odds and incredible resistance themselves in their efforts?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the first thing for me, and again, as for me as a reporter as well, I understand what you're saying, that writing itself is a form of resistance, because what we do is we hold the powerful to account, and we have to keep doing that, even though we see people like Trump, who 34 times convicted felon, adjudicated sexual abuser, still ascends to the highest office in power. It just, it almost doesn't make sense, and it can be depressing. But I think at the same time, we cannot just sit this one out. I think this calls for us to understand how we got here. We have to understand that history is our best teacher. What these young reformers teach us is just that. But most importantly, they teach us that freedom wasn't free. The likes of Ella Baker, the likes of Barbara Johns, the likes of Charlie Cobb, and so many more I cover in the book, they fought for it. Some of them died for it. Many bled for it. So I think when we understand how we got here, how we are the torchbearers to carry on the fight, whatever that means, I always say activism, the baseline definition is doing some kind of action, whether it's writing or marching or galvanizing, in hopes that it brings some kind of social or political change. I think all of us can do that. We can, you can start a book club. You can have more conversations. You can educate people on what it means to be misinformed. What is disinformation? What is misinformation? How to remove yourself from the insulation of social media. There are many ways we can all be part of this moment. Because yes, I do agree that we are entering what seems like a slow regression from how far we've got, you know, almost like we're entering this oligarchy that is a little scary given all the nominations that Trump has announced. It seems like it's just filling up the different cabinet positions with sycophants and flatterers, and that's scary. But I think we need to really hold on to hope. It's easy to just kind of get depressed and sit it out. But then what does that do? What is the alternative? Like more of our rights get stripped. More things like Dobbs and the affirmative action, more of those are going to happen. So if we don't step up and say, sure, this is not the outcome we were hoping for, but we do have a voice. What these young people teach us is our voice is so simple. Your voice is your weapon. And if you are silent, then you're giving away your power. So understanding that, I think, is really crucial. And understanding that this democracy that was so fought for, this democracy that we did inherit from these young people who fought for us, it's extremely precious. And it takes all of us right now to protect it. It's hard, but we have to do the hard work.
So you talk about it is a cyclical nature, progress, especially when it comes to justice. We see progress and we see regress. Yeah. And it seems to happen. I mean, I look at history and I see it, you know, over the course of decades, the progress that's followed by regress, which is followed by progress and regress. But it seems that lately, the cycle is even shorter, right? Because in 2020, it seemed that the nation, because we were all locked down and we were forced to see what happened to George Floyd, it shocked the nation in a way that there was this collective call for justice and there was allyship. But then that quickly seemed to fade, especially as attacks and fights against Black Lives Matter and labeling them as terrorists and all this took hold. We saw it again after the overturning of Roe v. Wade, when there was again this collective shock and this activism, but then once some laws passed in some places and some folks were protected, we saw in the results of elections and elsewhere that that issue began to fade again. So what did you learn in writing this book about perseverance throughout all of that? Because it can feel like you're getting somewhere and suddenly you're sliding backwards.
Yeah, it's a continuation. And as I say, the mantle continues to be passed on. And those of us who are inheritors of the fight, we have to keep going on. It's easy. Again, the easiest thing to do is just throw your hands up and say, I just can't. But when you understand how much coalition has been built, how much has been fought for, I understand things we never would have expected Dobbs to happen, right? Like a fundamental right to be stripped. But what that tells us is we're not doing enough to put up guardrails to protect democracy. When we have, again, people like Trump winning the way he did, what is that? It's like we're almost disconnected. I think this cycle, what I saw was there was a great disconnection with the Democratic Party from its base. They thought, well, because these people have always voted this way, they will. But what they really were doing were they were disconnected from the working class people. And the working class people almost were just like, we need to be heard, but we're not being heard. So I think there's something being lost in the messaging. There's something being lost in the passing of the mantle. And we're now reconnecting with the roots of what it means to fight for this democracy because we're not turning to history. When you don't understand how you got somewhere, it's easy to just disregard it. And so for me, what I really saw this last cycle was, especially with the Democratic Party, they just lost their connection and their understanding with the working class people. And that's one work that they need to work on right now. But I think writ large, it goes back again to understanding how we got here and how it's going to take all of us to continue to build coalitions. It's not enough to just say in one generation, it was done and that's it. We continue the fight. That dream that Martin Luther King talked about, we haven't even gotten there. But it's going to take literally every single person who understands the importance of democracy, who understands that what the Constitution stands for, who understands all of it. And you understand it with intentionality. You have to be intentional to understand how we got here. For me, it was personal because this country made me who I am. You know, all the things that I have, the education, the opportunities, it made me who I am. But yet I didn't understand the depths of this country. So this last 4 years of my research and the intentionality is how I got to this point now where I see what I'm doing as a form of resistance. So I think there needs to be a shift in how we think about things. There needs to be a shift in our framework so that all of us, we need to build a coalition right now, a new kind of coalition that would take the younger people and the older people, because older people brings a whole lot of experience. Younger people, what's exciting about younger people is that they're very idealistic, but older people, they're more pragmatic because they were once idealistic. Then they got into the fight and they're like, wait a minute now, there's a lot of red tape. It's hard to build this coalition, but we need both. And we need to continue to build a new kind of coalition because we're evolving as a society. We're now in the era of Trump as a GOP party, Trumpism as a GOP party. Who would have ever thought that the party of Reagan would not be the party of Trump? It's maddening, but we can't let that hold us back. We have to continue to build coalitions that work, but also that are intentional and have history be that underpinning baseline that helps us.
Yes, and it's so important. The coalition, the older people know the history. And that's an important thing. Like we said, we never thought that the party of Reagan would become the party of Trump. Well, if you look at history, it was once the party of Lincoln. And it has had quite the trajectory through Jim Crow and everything else that got us to the place where the Republican Party is now. But I want to talk about young people a little bit more because you focus on that in this book. Young people are fed up, you know? So how do we, and you can't blame them, right? They are inheriting a world that they feel like they've inherited a world on fire. You know, I think about my own my own stepchildren who are in their 20s barely remember the Obama administration, right? Mm. Everything about their connection to the political world has been really the Trump era for the last decade. So how do you encourage young people to get in this fight when I gotta imagine if you're coming in on this fresh and you're seeing this, you would not be blamed for thinking, what in actual hell? So how do you encourage the next generation of people to join this resistance?
Yeah, they are the torchbearers, right? And they are active. They are very active. I think David Hogg, he's running for DNC vice chair. I said, I hope he gets it. We need that because young people inject a new energy. Again, they're very idealistic, but you need that idealism to say we can do anything. And then you need that balance of idealism and pragmatic. I say I'm a practical dreamer. You need that, right? You need to have someone who's fighting for what could be, someone who's fighting to uphold what the Constitution wants this country, this nation to be. And that's what young people do. And I want them to know that they do have the power. I think about how social media has changed how they protest, has changed how they galvanize, has changed how they organize. So I actually think the young people are the one who are keeping the momentum and the fight. And again, when I saw David Hogg running, I said, I never expected that, but I said, that's exactly what this moment is calling for. Because so many things that has happened the last 4 years has been unprecedented, right? So we're in a time where we've never been here before. And I think young people are showing us how exactly to continue the fight and how to continue to keep that vigor going, because we're going to need that for especially the next 4 years. So I do think they are. I think they are keenly aware of what's happening. They are very much plugged in. And I think I would just encourage them to not let what they're seeing right now limit them, because it's going to take the continuation of their fight, the continuation of being brazen and audacious to say, I could run for DNC vice chair. I'm only, 24, 25. I have a voice in this fight because it's my country. It's my future. So I've seen it. Even with the book bans, there were a lot of protesting by young people, by teenagers. So I don't think they need me to say anything to them. But if they do need a word of encouragement, is you got to keep going. You know, the next 4 years is a fight for your life, a fight for our future. And I have seen them, especially most of my students too, they're very plugged in. They're all mostly Gen Z. They're very plugged in. And they know that it's going to take all of them to continue to stay plugged in, to keep going and using their voice as their weapon.
Rita, thank you so much for joining me today. Again, the name of your book is Resist: How a Century of Young Black Activists Shaped America. Rita Omoka, thank you so much for joining us on Justice by Design.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you.
Well, I don't know about all of you, but I really needed that. I feel a literal shift of my spirit from where I started before my conversation with Rita to where I am right now. And sometimes that is what we need. We need that reminder of what's at stake, what history has taught us, what the work of fearless activists can do to inspire us. And, you know, we need to be clear about what the path forward is, especially with what lies ahead. So I am grateful to Rita, and I am grateful to all of you for listening to Justice by Design. Follow the podcast wherever you get your podcast. You can catch it on YouTube too if you want to watch our conversation at the Politicon channel. And I appreciate you doing that. And from the bottom of my heart, I wish everybody a Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and a joyful everything. Take care.